This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This podcast is brought to you by the Institute for Excellence in Writing. IEW provides teachers and teaching parents with methods and materials which will aid them in training students to become better listeners, speakers, readers, writers, and thinkers. To learn more about IEW and their 100% lifetime money-back guarantee, visit IEW.com/start. Again, that's IEW.com/start. Hello, and welcome back to The Mason Jar here on the Searcy Institute Podcast Network. I am David Kern, and this being The Mason Jar, I am joined by Cindy Rollins. Cindy, how's it going?
It's going very well.
So we are here once again to talk about a question that was sent to us by a listener. I think most of the questions that we get are probably fairly common. Some of them are a little more specific, like about poetry or grammar, you know, where people have very specific concerns about how to teach this or include it in their school life. But I think this one is probably something that, while not as specific to curricula, it is still going to be pretty universal to most people, at least during some seasons. And that is how to be faithful without being frantic or fear-driven. So we had a question that came in, and the person says, I often fight fear of failure, not giving my kids what they, you know, that I'm not going to give my kids what they need, you know, and so forth, which is compounded by the fact, and this particular person says that this person says her oldest son is dyslexic. So that makes it reading difficult, and so then that creates more fear and anxiety in her that she's not going to give him what he needs. So she says, you know, talks to a lot of other people, seems like a normal problem. So she wants to know if you can address some of the ways to fight this mental and emotional battle well. How can we guard ourselves to make sure we're really doing a good job educating our children while not living in a constant state of self-assessment and condemnation? So, you know, simple question. You know, nothing to, this will be an easy one for you.
Yeah, we'll just bat this round.
Would you agree though that this is probably one that all homeschool moms deal with?
Yeah, I definitely think this is at the heart.
Homeschool mom, I don't know for sure.
Yeah, I think it's definitely at the heart of what a homeschool mom faces every day. Am I doing enough? Am I educating my children? And because it's a constant state of discouragement between what we plan to do, what we imagine ourselves doing, and what actually happens when, you know, the day gets going. And also I think it's our deep love for our children. So yeah. We have a child, a dyslexic child, or a child with some sort of learning impediment or challenge. And we feel it so deeply in our heart that it can cause us to have a lot of insecurity about what we're doing.
Yeah, we don't want to let them down.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, this doesn't sound very unique to just homeschoolers, right? I mean, to just, you know, to...
Parent, no.
Yeah, parent, I mean, or even in the classroom, we're all discouraged by what we planned to do and didn't get done, or the students in our classrooms that we've been you know, given who are having some kind of challenges or something. Like, you know, I think it just makes me realize I can, this can kind of resonates with me even not as a homeschooling mom.
Yeah. And I think that's a really good point. I think we imagine there's a place where this isn't going on. We imagine that there's this perfect school where everything goes,
classroom. You know,
each day is planned and each day fulfills its purpose. And at the end of the day, nothing went wrong and everybody's learning. And that just doesn't exist. I've watched, you know, I'm heavily involved with a local Charlotte Mason tutorial. And I've watched, you know, the challenges they face. And my son has gone to public school and I've watched the challenges that the teachers face there. It's not so very different than what a mom faces at home. There isn't a play. The first thing to realize, I think the first cure for the mental side of this is to realize that there isn't a cure. There's no place where you can take your children where this would not be going on, where what is planned to happen happens.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the questioner says, how can we guard ourselves to make sure we're really doing a good job educating our children while not living in a constant state of self-assessment and condemnation? And I think what we do, well, I imagine homeschool moms do this from talking to them, but I know what I've done in the classroom is you have these plans, right? And you think the plans are going to be, as you put it, the cure.
Right.
They're going to be what enables you to do a good job. And then we rely so much on the plans, and the plans are not going to ultimately save us. So is there a way to, you know, I mean, we still have to plan. Are there ways of planning that can be helpful in allowing and keeping us from being fearful? You know, a lot of people plan because without the plans, there's high anxiety. The plan diminishes the anxiety. So I guess my question for you is there a way, are there some principles that can sort of inform the way we plan or the way we prepare ourselves and our students that can help diminish the anxiety that often comes with teaching?
Yeah, I think that if we were more realistic about our plans, and one way we might do this is to build in some margins, like maybe only plan 4 days a week. It maybe it'll take you 5 days a week to get through those 4 days, but now you've built in a buffer, and you feel successful. You don't feel like a failure at the end of the week, because I'm going to tell you, there's hardly been a week in my life of homeschool planning that I didn't have to transfer some things over to the next week. You know, I had to, and that's why the plotting is so important, and to realize that we're just going to do as much as we can today, and then we're going to pick up where we left off, and tomorrow, and we're going to do some more, and each day we're going to slowly keep moving through this atmosphere and discipline in life. And I do think if we think of it as an atmosphere, discipline in life, and not as a plan, then we are going to have a little more freedom not to be a slave to our plans.
Do you think that the idea that, you know, education is about, well, do you think the plans, this was not a pre-prepared question. Do you think that the plans can sometimes cause us to sort of implicitly think of education as too much about getting these things done or getting checklists done, as opposed to education, especially in the home, is about cultivating that atmosphere? Do you think that the plans can sort of, without us meaning to, cause us to operate that way?
Absolutely. I think that we overplan. We have, because we want so much, we hear so much, we want to do so much. And yet, in the very thing we're trying to do, we're undercutting our, not just our well-being, but we're actually undercutting the education of our children, because we are not, that we have not built in the time that they need to absorb and process things, because we're just on this train that has to keep going, and that's why school is so appealing. It seems like it's the train that just keeps on moving, whereas, you know, at home the train keeps getting interrupted and we have to stop periodically and we have, you know, go do the laundry, switch the laundry around, mm-hmm. all these things yeah. that come up in a home can keep us. So I do think, and this is where I think it's so sad that the Charlotte Mason community has become really what you almost say overrun with riches. So much out there, so many good ideas. This person does, you know, nature notebooks beautifully. And this person, is doing these wonderful Swedish drill exercises. And this family is singing with beautiful harmonies. And all those things are wonderful, wonderful things. Mm-hmm. But then we try to have our homeschools include all of them all the time. They just can't bear the weight of that. They genuinely cannot bear the weight of so many wonderful things. And so we have to drop back and actually let go of some things, which is so hard to do. I struggled with that. Even this year, I know the plans that I have for my student are overly ambitious. And yet when I go to look at my schedule, I'm like, well, I don't want to take out that. I don't want to take out that. But as the day comes and we're going from thing to thing, I'm going to have a choice. I'm either going to stress my student out by pushing him to finish something really quickly so we can get on to the next thing, or I'm going to drop those things off at the time because I realize that he cannot get the quality out of what he is doing if I'm pushing him to get on to the next thing. And so that's the tension.
I've caught myself before, you know, when teaching literature, when you get the freedom to sort of at least partially curate your own curriculum, you tend to put in the things that you love a lot. And so yeah. I've caught myself be reading one book and we'll be going a little bit through it and I'll look and I'll be thinking, oh no, Christmas break's coming up, or oh shoot, the standardized testing is coming up or whatever. So I know that I want to get to this other book that I really love and I really want them to read it. So then we start pushing our way through this other book that I really love, and then that keeps them from loving it. And so it's just this ironic cycle of, you know, sabotage, self-sabotage. So do you think then that what we need to do is find a way to, to kind of recognize, okay, we love all these different things. These are all, whether it's a subject, a book, or a resource, these are amazing things. They're beautiful things. They're things that we would love to include. But then is the goal, then we need to distill things down to just what is most essential?
Well, I think...
Or is that putting too fine a point on it?
Yeah, I think I think that we need to start with the essentials, obviously. And we don't want to leave out all what some people call the riches. We want to think of the riches as essential. So I don't want to say that, but at the same time, maybe.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
But we maybe want to realize that here we have this whole group of riches, and maybe we can only pick, you know, we don't get to have five courses of dessert. We have to choose. Our meal has to be varied. And so maybe we can't do singing and nature notebook and Swedish drill and paper sloyd. Maybe something has to give. Something definitely has to give. I can tell you that if you don't want to go completely insane.
if you don't want to feel frantic.
Right. And I've seen some people take the concept of short lessons down to try to include everything to become so short where we're going to do this for 5 minutes. We're going to do this for 5 minutes. And it becomes a little, then you're rushing through those 5 minutes in order. Really, you can't bear up under that. Eventually you'll crash. Your homeschool
will
crash.
Not restful to go from one thing to the other. Just as much as it is to try to do too many things.
Right. So you end up with, I'm in the middle of writing something right now. And one of the things that keeps coming up over and over again in my mind is if you want all or nothing, you get nothing. That's what Edith Schaefer said. And I think this is here. This is the getting back to the basic question of how to handle all this fear and anxiety is that we have to accept the fact that we're not going to have it all. We're going to have to accept the limitations of our students. I happen to think that dyslexic children that the homeschool environment is a huge plus for those children, because mom is there to read to them, and they aren't missing out. They're not behind, because they're still moving forward with this great curriculum. Especially if they're using Ambleside Online, they can't read this themselves because it's too difficult, but they can certainly understand it when their mom reads it. And that's a huge benefit to children who might traditionally be considered learning disabled. They get to the other end of their graduation. They still might not do that great on their standardized testing. They still may be weak in the skills that we test that are standardized. But these children are going to be far advanced to where their counterparts are, and many times they're going to be advanced in their ability to go through college classes. Sure, they may not be able to test well, but when they get into the class, they're going to be to interact with ideas. These are children who have been handed ideas, have been interacting with them, and are able to carry that over to college. And often they do very well in college by the time that comes around. And I say that from experience. Like you always say, David, it's not, this is all anecdotal, but no. I have seen enough of that, and the last book I read on all these studies, it was like, we did a study, we manipulated these people, and this is what we found. I'm like, well, it sounds like they had like five people. So yeah. I think that we could stand on our experience.
Yeah. Do you think that the person in the question talked about, she used the words frantic and fear driven. Do you think that the franticness comes from the fear, or the fear comes from the franticness? I mean, or am I, mm-hmm. I mean, is that even,
I don't, yeah, I mean, I'm sure they feed off of each other. I'm sure that once you're afraid, you're frantic. And then once you're frantic, you're afraid. I think the key is, once again, to just be faithful day by day, and to accept your limitations. But there are moms who
are superheroes.
Well, there are superhero moms, but there are people who maybe need to be a little more disciplined. So I don't want to be like, oh, yes, it's all going to work out. All you have to do is just be happy and everything will work out. You do, as a homeschooling mom, there is a certain amount of discipline that goes into being a homeschooling mom. But that discipline should not be a heroic effort. It should be the normal discipline of a human being going through their day. But if you're not able to reach that discipline, that normal discipline that humans need to thrive, then you should work on those things. But most homeschooling moms are not lazy. Yeah. You know, they're sure, we do all have times when we are mentally fatigued and we just can't, you know, there is a time to stop homeschooling for a month and regroup. That happens. And it's perfectly normal. That does not mean you're not disciplined. There are times when you have morning sickness and you're just not going to get through a lot. You can, if you're faithful during the times when you do feel well and when you're not mentally fatigued, then your life can bear up and your homeschool can bear up under those times when things come crashing down, you have extra stress for whatever reason. But there is a sense of being faithful to plug away at it and also accept when you can't.
So there's this, the other part of this question, the other two words that stuck out to me were self-assessment. Well, we'll call that a hyphenated word, and condemnation. So you're assessing the job that you've done, and then you find that you are lacking and thus begin to think about yourself. You begin to condemn yourself and the job that you're doing. Was that, without being, you know, too personal here, was that something that you experienced?
Well, yeah. I mean, I definitely think there was always this fear of not living up to, you know, my ideals. Mm-hmm. And in the end, in some ways, I didn't. I mean, let's just look on the other side of it. Did I live up to my ideals that I had? No, I did not. I fell short, as I was going to do. And that's what I've come to now. And this is where the condemnation is I am not under condemnation for falling short of my own ideals, the ideals that I had for my homeschool. Do I wish I hadn't fallen short? Sure. But, I did. So, I look at my kids and I'm pretty content that they're all productive members of the culture, and they're very, you know, they own houses, they have jobs, they, you know, all the things that people want to see they have. And they're hardworking people who frankly kind of impressive when you talk to them. So I mean, it, whether I get credit for that, which I probably don't, or whether they just were given the opportunity on their own to blossom and grow, they did do that. And how you measure that is maybe that's where moms need to get away from the whole assessment. We know that standardized testing for young children over the course of every year is a negative that leads to poor outcomes, really. But do we know that for ourselves, that that not all of our most of our children are quite ordinary. They're just regular children. They're not geniuses. Or horrible. That's exactly right. So my dad used to tease me that I always said, when I'd have a new baby, I'd be like, oh, he's really above average. This baby is something else. And I did. I thought that about all my children. And I still do. But the truth is that they're just regular humans that just like me. And
yeah.
And so are every other mom's children out there.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, you said, is it to your credit that your kids turned out well? Probably partly, but also I think the thing that, and your husband's, got to give some credit to your husband.
Yes, definitely.
But also, you know, we need to remember that, you know, our children are not just ours, right? Like if we make a mistake, we're not the only ones who have made plans for them, and we're not the only ones who are watching out for them. And you know, one of the things that we talk a lot about here, and my dad talks a lot about it, is the idea of repentance and prayer. And as parents and teachers, you know, when we make a mistake, we need to repent and be prayerful and try to do better. But we also need to remember that just because, you know, we make a mistake doesn't mean that everything, it's the end for them, right? Like, God's right. Watching out for right. them. We're here, you know, as
we place our, so we're not God. So we placed ourselves as God over their lives in our minds. And so when things fall apart, exactly. We don't realize we weren't holding the whole thing up anyway. Yes. We let things down, but something else is actually holding the structure up. Thank goodness. Thank the Lord. and it's not us. So it's
our
right.
mistakes are not going to cause our children to, crumble.
Yeah, especially as we, you know, when we desire to do well. And I think, and I do, I'm glad you brought up the idea of prayer and repentance, because all, you know, it is true that education is repentance. And so that means that when we are educating our children, there is going to be a good amount of repentance each year and each day as we get up to go about it. Okay, here's what I did wrong yesterday. Here's what they didn't do right. Here's what they don't know. We all need to kind of repent in a kind of overarching theme and get up today and learn again. And I think that's true. And I do think that we underestimate the value of prayer in the lives of our children. And as you lose control of them as they grow up, you know, prayer becomes a bigger part of your life, because while you think you're in control, you don't think of prayer as much. But once you realize it's out of your control, then you're very, very, your next recourse is to pray and to seek God. And that turns out to be awesome, because God is effective, and what he does work, And it's so much better that way.
His plans are actually gonna
be yeah, they come to pass. Yeah. They actually work out the way
you know. Sorry, the internet is just the worst thing for these things. I thought it was just this long silence there, and you were still talking. Sorry.
Oh, I thought you were talking about for making you feel bad about yourself. Like,
well, so my friend Josh Gibbs, we just published a book by him called How to Be Unlucky: Reflections on the Pursuit of Virtue. And one of the big themes of this book that I really like is the idea that as teachers, it's a very valuable thing for us to be open, I guess, repentant before our students, to show them that, you know, we don't always have all the answers and that sometimes we do make mistakes. And that part of the relationship between a student and a teacher, a part of a healthy relationship is when the teacher can say, oh, I got that wrong. Or, you know, let's take a step back and let's say, I taught this poorly. You know, there's a lot of value in saying, you know what? I can see that you don't understand what I'm trying to say here. You didn't get this. That's not your fault. That's my fault. Let's take a step back and let's work on that some more. And it doesn't have to be something where, you know, it's not this huge flaw in all of your homeschooling or all of your plans. And it's not this big flaw in your students. It's just the nature of learning. Sometimes things take longer than you expect. And so if you're realistic about it, you take a step back and you say, let's pause. Let's keep working on this. It doesn't have to be a big deal. And I think sometimes when we don't accomplish what we wanted to accomplish, it becomes such a big failure. Sometimes it's not a failure. Yeah. Sometimes it's just the process of learning.
Right. And I think that's where you see it in your students and then you see it in yourself, where people don't want to learn something. They want to already know it.
Or sometimes we don't want to teach something. We want our kids to already know it.
Yes. But it's very hard to go to a child and say, you can love math, and they don't love it. And the only reason they don't love it is because they don't know it. Mm-hmm. And so, part of, I guess, the art of teaching is to help the child overcome that and say, oh, I can love. Or, and we were talking about grammar on another podcast where, you know, you can love this. You don't love it because you don't know it. But so many times you see kids get almost angry or frustrated because they get to that point where they don't know. And that's where they're supposed to be if they're being educated. That's where we're all supposed to be. Where is that point where we don't know? Mm-hmm. And that should be a great point. We should all embrace that.
Yeah.
And be happy. Oh, now I know what I need to know. Now I know what way to go. But instead, we, you know, we see that frustration and anger that comes up, or giving up. The giving up happens frequently. Where, you know, I'm not going to do this. It's too hard. I don't know it. Well, you don't know it. You've never learned it.
And I think that when we get to a point where we recognize something that either that maybe as a school, as a classroom, or as a group, or whatever, as a family, whatever it is, that you don't, when you get to a point where you recognize that you don't know something well, we can make it look like, okay, we've failed and we don't know something. And so then that's where this frustration comes in. Or we can color that, so to speak, in a way for our students that as an opportunity. Like, this is a beautiful thing. We now know what we need to know. And so we can work towards that. We have a goal and we can bit by bit get to that goal.
Yeah. So it all works. I mean, it works both ways with the parent who's planning and the student who's learning. It all comes into play basically because we're all humans and we have the same frustrations and weaknesses.
And our students, if we feel like we're condemning ourselves, our students are condemning themselves too.
Yes. You know,
they're judging themselves for the quality of the things that they're doing, especially as they get older, right? And they're feeling every failure. Right. You know, everything they don't know, they're feeling as a failure. That's sort of one of the things that's natural about schooling, but it's also a problem. And that's where the atmosphere that we're cultivating really matters.
Yeah, and I've noticed this, and I'm writing a little bit about this, but pretty much anybody you talk to says they want to educate their children differently than they were educated, because when they get to the end of their education, they have all these holes. Well, we live in a massive world of knowledge and information, and there's just no way to learn it all in those 12 years that we have. So we all come out of it with holes, and whenever we come up with a hole, we're so humiliated.
Yeah, we feel it really profoundly.
Yeah, that we just get mad at the people who taught us instead of thinking,
my kid's not going to have that hole. No matter what else I do, they're not going to have that hole. hole.
Yeah, so they have these other gaping holes, but they don't have the hole that you had. So I found that to be really fascinating, watching people. And this is where Charlotte Mason is so right, where she says that all education is self-education. It wasn't the system that failed you. You really weren't failed in any way. It's just you're now up to you to find out what you need to know and learn it, because nobody is able to. You know, we often don't know what we're preparing for because we don't know the future. And I will say this, the world of 1980, when I started having children in 1984, is so, I could not have predicted the world we live in today. I couldn't have predicted it even a tiny bit. It's a mystery how we got here in my mind. You know, what in the world is this? But there wasn't a school on earth that was preparing their children for this culture that we live in now, because nobody knew. And so we all are, this is where the liberal arts and a wide, generous curriculum is so much more important than technical skills or learning, you know, things that, well, that will fit into where we are right now, because we don't know the future. We don't know, the only thing we really know now is the thing that we're doing today, whether it's Instagram or Snapchat, is not going to be the thing we're doing tomorrow.
That's true. You know, I think you mentioned the idea that the idea of education being, you know, a lifetime thing. And I think that if we focus on less on, I mean, we got to teach them very specific things. There are specific skills and specific knowledge we need to teach. But if we can also teach our kids to, and prepare them to be lifelong learners, if we can teach them to value asking questions, to teach them the kind of questions to ask, to see what think gaps as opportunities, things like that, then, you know, I think we'll have done a good job, even if we don't finish the textbook.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think we very rarely do finish a textbook.
Who finishes textbooks?
I actually finished the textbooks a lot of times, but it took me, you know, 2 years instead of 1 year, 3 years. Yeah. So it might take a while, but just to just keep getting up in the morning, brush yourself off and keep going, is most of the battle.
You know, it strikes me, there's a big difference between finishing a textbook and finishing a textbook so you can get to the next one sooner.
Yeah.
So what you just described, you spent 2 years on a textbook. So you were patient with it and you let it be a resource that fit into the atmosphere that you were cultivating, as opposed to trying to finish a textbook because you need to get to the next textbook. And those are two very different things.
Yeah. I think that is a part of the problem, is that we're rushing through material, because we want to finish it, not because we actually want to learn it. And I think that is part of the frustration when we get to high school and we feel this immense pressure to take biology, and we're supposed to learn this much biology in this amount of time. Well, I noticed, you know, my son's class in a public school, they didn't get through even a quarter, hardly. I mean, they may have gotten through half the textbook. They didn't come anywhere near getting through the entire textbook. And yet, you know, they were, so who knows biology? Now, I know there are probably really good private schools that actually get through the textbook, and the kids are challenged a little more, and they do learn more, but
maybe
or they memorize more for a short period of time. Let's put it that way. But it definitely is not, finishing a textbook is not actually learning the material either.
Well, you brought the seven liberal arts. That's where the quadrivium and the seven liberal arts and the quadrivium and sort of the traditional classical approaches can be valuable guides as far as how you choose what to study and what you're focusing on and what you kind of view as essential.
And I think they can help us to push away all the confusion of our current educational thing, say, this has been important for these thousands of years and it's still important.
Yeah.
It's not massive amounts of stuff. It's these seven liberal arts. After that, we can add to it. But this is the basic of what an educated person knows.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good place to stop. Thank you again for bringing your wisdom and your experience to this question. Hopefully it was helpful for people who are feeling, I imagine and everybody who teaches feels this at some time, as we kind of said at the top. It's not like this isn't happening.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
Yeah. It's hard to see moms downcast and know that they're really trying to do their very best and they just don't feel encouraged, really.
Yeah. Do you have any recommended resources for this topic that off the top of your head that we could put in the show notes for people?
I didn't think about this ahead of time.
Yeah, I didn't ask you that one ahead of time.
Yeah, let me think. I think that any book that is spiritually uplifting, like mom, things that are for mom's own benefit, her own growth as a person, can really, really help her to stay focused on herself as a person, not just the kids, is very important at this stage in time, because she can often get lost in the plans and the curriculum and not really have her own personal growth going on, which sounds, when I say this, it makes it sound like, and now on top of all that, you need to add this, but really you would really need to add that first. You really need to make sure that you're being fed by some source, you know, most especially the Bible. And then, you know, there's some really good books about, liturgy and the liturgy of moms and the liturgy of just the ordinary life, the whole idea that the way we go about our days matter, whether it's doing something glorious like making homeschooling plans, which you always feel so good when you make those plans, or something mundane like taking out the garbage, how all of those things matter, and all of those things work together, not just, but anyway, I'm trying to think of I'm reading a book and I can't think of the name of it. I think it's called Seeking God, and it's by Esther DeWall. It is such a lovely little book on ordering our days, and it's not specifically for mothers, but it is about the Benedictine kind of lifestyle as applied to real life and not living in some monastery. And I'm really enjoying that book. But that's Esther DeWall, and she has many books on this subject. And this is just the first one I've read.
Well, we'll wrap it up there. But again, thank you for answering this question, for joining me for the show. Thank you for sending in the questions to people who have been doing that. If you have a question you'd like us to cover on a future episode, you can email either Cindy or me. I'm at david@sourceyinstitute.com and Cindy@ordo-amoris.com. That's right, right? Did I remember that correctly?
That is right. There you go.
We'll try to get to, you know, as many questions over the weeks as we can. If you want to hear more from Cindy, you can head over to the Patreon account, patreon.com/masonjar, I guess, and you can listen to her reading and commenting on Charlotte Mason's book themselves in 5 to 15 minute, approximately that, 5 to 15 minute increments at a time. So again, that's patreon.com/masonjar. And I guess that's it. Cindy, any final thoughts?
No, I think that's good.
All right. Well, for Cindy Rollins, for all of us here at the Circe Institute, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening to The Mason Jar, and we'll talk to you next time.